Sheffield Live. Made in Sheffield, made by you.
If you like rock in all its forms, you will love Glory Days. You can listen to us locally on 93.2 FM and on the telly, and anywhere in the world on sheffieldlive.org. What do you think, Dawn? You know what? I think he likes it. That's Glory Days, every Monday 1 till 3 here on Sheffield Live. Bosh, bosh. Oops, I've had an accident.
Hello, I'm Harry Wilburn. I present Steel and Wire every Wednesday, 10 a.m. Americana, bluegrass, American roots, and more. Lots more. Lots of guests, lots of local music and musicians. That's Steel and Wire, Wednesday, 10 a.m.
You are listening to fabulous Harry Wilburn on Steel and Wire.
Where no man has gone before.
It's time to open the music box. Join me, Steve Roden, every Thursday morning between 10 and 12 for music from the 40s to the 90s from my own music collection. Songs I've grown up with, ones I am sure you will enjoy hearing again. Hope to see you then.
If you love new music and you want to discover the best new artists out there, then tune into The Backroom with me, Paddy. I'll be playing the best of new indie, electro, EDM and punk and showcasing new Sheffield talent. Also music news, local and national gig guide and new album releases. So tune into The Backroom every Thursday night between 6 and 7pm here on Sheffield Live, 93.2 FM.
This is Sheffield Live.
N-E-X-T.
Good morning. Welcome to the Life Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM on digital if you're in South Yorkshire or sheffieldlive.org. You can listen online there and also download the podcast later and listen at your leisure. You've got Julian Pauly live in the studio as usual. We'll be talking to our PG later in this hour. Our guest speaker this Saturday, and indeed whenever there are five Saturdays in the month, it's Phil Muffett from the Mexburn Swinton Astronomical Society. He'll be telling us all about his visit to Jodrell Bank, amongst yes. other things. How exciting.
Nice.
He'll also be with us next week, all being well, to do his Eye on the Sky, etc., and club news. A reminder that Sheffield Photographic Society, their open photography competition is ongoing. 21st of February deadline. You can email spsphotography514@gmail.com for more information, or just check them out on Facebook or social media. A reminder also, at smartphonefreechildhood.org, Google it and sign the parent pact online if you wish, and join parents in your area who are delaying smartphones and social media. Next up is a great story I got from the RHS magazine. That's a Royal Horticultural Society magazine. It was all about moles. And really to appreciate them a bit more, perhaps. Anyway, there were some mole facts, as well as quite a big story about them. First fact was, adult moles live alone in a network of tunnels with territory spanning at least 400 square metres, and that's the equivalent of 2 tennis courts. Fact number 2, moles eat worms, as well as larvae such as chafer grubs and leather jackets. Third fact was, a mole can dig 4.5 metres of deep tunnel per day, and much more at the surface. Fact number 4, the mole's velvety coat helps it slip through soil. Number 5, an extra bone in each hand, called the radial sesamoid, makes for more efficient digging and pushing of soil. And the final facts from this article, females have a rare masculinized biology, producing high levels of testosterone, making them as aggressively territorial as the male moles. Who knew, eh? And now, Paul, over to Paul for what's been in the science news this week.
Yes, solar and wind power generated more electricity than fossil fuels in the EU for the first time last year. The report from EMBER, E-M-B-E-R, a global energy think tank, found that these two renewable sources generated 30% of the EU's electricity compared with 29% for coal and gas. Meanwhile, the UK is set to back a vast new fleet of offshore wind projects in the North Sea alongside nine other European countries, including Norway, Germany and the Netherlands. For the first time, some of the new wind farms will be linked to multiple countries through undersea cables known as interconnectors. A network of undersea cables already connects the electricity grids of European countries. The UK has 10 such cables, but connecting wind farms directly to multiple countries will be a first. Most energy economists agree that more connections between the UK and other European grids should reduce electricity costs and improve the security of supply. And finally, the UK government has also just announced its long-awaited Warm Homes Plan, which promises to provide £15 billion to households across the UK over the next 5 years via low interest loans and grants to fund solar panels, heat pumps and batteries. By switching households away from oil heaters and gas boilers to electrical heat pumps powered by renewable energy, the government hopes it will cut the country's planet warming emissions, of which around 18% come from home heating. The new Warm Homes Plan includes extending the boiler upgrade scheme by a further year to 2029-2030. With grants available for air source heat pumps, making more funds available to low-income households to cover the full costs of solar panels and batteries, and offering low and zero-interest loans for households irrespective of income.
All good stuff. Yes. I've just tuned in, you're listening to the Life Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM, talking about science in all its different forms. Next up is a story very close to my heart, and after we've spoke about this, we're going to be playing a great track that RPG will love, Santana, that's all I can say. This was an article by somebody called Paul Simons, Weather Eye by Paul Simons. He does a regular slot about all sorts of things, but he's talking here about the Beaufort scale. And if you're a sailor in particular, you'll certainly know what that is. So in the days of sailing ships, the wind was crucially important, but anemometers had not been invented. So the only way to measure the force of the wind was by describing how the ship's sails behaved or what the sea looked like. There was no agreed way of comparing the observations from different ships worldwide, and a universal scale was needed. So eventually, in January 1806, Captain Francis Beaufort, in command of HMS Woolwich, serving the Rio de la Plata estuary of Uruguay, wrote in his logbook, "Hereafter, I shall estimate the force of the wind according to the following scale," which he ordered from 0 for calm to 12 for hurricane force. A year later, he added descriptions of the wind force. One indicated light air was that which will enable a man of war to steer. 5 was a fresh breeze when a ship must start to reduce her sails, which means take sail in, make it smaller. Violent storm at 11 was when the wind was that which would blow away any sail made in the usual way. So the Beaufort scale gradually evolved over the years until in 1906 a committee expanded the Beaufort scale into more poetic descriptions of the sea and wind strength to be used by weather observers based on the coast. The descriptions also gave wind speeds in miles per hour, so that 0 on the scale was winds of less than 1 mile per hour, in which smoke rises vertically and sea like a mirror, to force 2, light breeze, 4 to 7 miles per hour, wind felt on the face, leaves rustle on the trees, wind vane moved by wind, small wavelets on sea. Get to 4-6, get more interesting. Strong breeze, 25 to 31 miles per hour, large branches in motion, whistling heard in telegraph wires, umbrellas are used with difficulty, large waves, extensive foam crests. And at the most violent end of the scale, 10, was storm force, 55 to 63 miles per hour, trees uprooted. And Force 12 was hurricane with winds over 73 miles per hour and devastation. Air filled with foam and spray, very poor visibility. The Beaufort scale has carried on in robust health to the present day, perhaps best known on the shipping forecast. Beaufort himself, or Captain Francis Beaufort, his full name, himself is recognised as one of the great pioneers of meteorology. How interesting, eh? What a shame to turn that track off. Santana there, Song of the Wind, because we're talking about the Beaufort scale. How interesting. You listen to Life Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM. We should have our PG on the line. Morning, PG.
Good morning.
How time flies. Doesn't seem 2 minutes since we spoke to you last Saturday.
I know. Sorry, your looks run out again.
I know. Brilliant. So what's caught your eye in the science news this week then?
Oh, I think on the local front, something that's interesting for people who get involved in creative arts is the some research from the University of Sheffield. Creative arts are a vital gateway to digital inclusion for older people, their research has found. So they say that engaging with digital arts and cultural activities is a critical step in building digital confidence in older people who are often excluded from the online world. So it's one of those things. I mean, we've been continually forced to go online for things. I think even things like identity now are being pushed online for a lot of older people. And it's not always a comfortable place. So this is saying that getting involved in creative activities like digital photography, online local history research, serve as a vital entry point to the digital world for 2.3 million over 65s in the UK, and that's from Age UK 2024, who are not digitally included according to the university's research. They found engaging in creative activities can build confidence and motivation to help older people engage with digital services. And beyond the social connection, digital engagement can empower them with people with limited mobility or health challenges through tools like using tablets, smartphones, or voice-to-text software. So looking through what they're doing, they say that over 2 million people are affected by it. The researcher, Dr. Sharon Wagg, Dr. Pam McKinney and Laura Woods, with support from Maria Mandu, investigated how voluntary community and social enterprise organisations use digital arts and cultural activities to encourage older people to use digital technology. So, interesting research and probably a good guide, but anybody who feels a bit creative, the digital world can be very interesting and maybe make you more familiar with the tools, the computers and other ways of accessing the digital world for older people. So I thought that was quite an interesting bit of news. But beyond that, I was reading an article on the BBC about artificial intelligence development. And this is Google's DeepMind artificial intelligence model is looking to, it could actually transform the understanding of DNA. The model's called Alpha Genome, and it could help scientists discover why there are subtle differences in our DNA. And the ones that can put us at risk of conditions like high blood pressure, dementia, obesity. And they say that the human genome model is up to 3 billion letters of DNA code that are represented by letters A, C, G, and T. But of those, only 2% are genomes that code all the proteins that are needed in the human body for growth and function. That leaves 98%, which are less well understood and have been labelled the dark genome. So they're crucial in organising how genes are used in the body, and it's where many functions are linked to disease are found. So Alpha Genome has been analysing the genetic code, and it manages to analyse a million letters of code at a time. So that's helping to start to unravel this dark genome. And that can predict where our genes are, but also where the dark genome is influencing them. So how it affects what's called gene expression. That's the whether the gene's highly active or it's suppressed. So you can see to that. And crucially, the model can predict the impact of changing even a single letter of the genetic code. So it's been described in some detail in the journal Nature, and it was made available for non-commercial use, and 3,000 plus scientists have since used the model to start studying the genome. And it's sort of opening up lots of avenues for development in drug treatments, and sort of moving things forward. And again, AI, I think we've had a lot of noise this week about the stopping the use of mobile phones in schools, and the worries about how the digital world's impacting upon us. So it's interesting to see this aspect of the digital world doing something positive. And who knows, as I say, it could open a significant gateway to health. So I thought that was an interesting use of the code. And it's an interesting use of artificial intelligence. So,
as with all science, Paul, isn't it? It has its pluses and its minuses. And the power of AI, if it's used in the right way for science and medical research, it's phenomenal, that amount of sifting and going through, you know, big amounts of information and making those connections.
Yes. Well, and this artificial intelligence actually handles it in a different way to things like ChatGPT and the sort of common ones that have been popping up in the news for their abilities to do lots of manipulations that we may or may not want. This actually sort of looks at the material in a different way by taking these huge chunks of data and making comparisons over several million times to look at these relationships within our genetic framework. So it's developing around the world. I think Facebook have announced that they're going to double their investment into artificial intelligence in the recent weeks. So there's a real sort of major push, and a lot of things are starting to move forward. I think we touched on robotics before, and again in the news this week, I think the company Tesla, Elon Musk's famous sort of relationship to them, are starting, they've discontinued two of their electric vehicle models, and they're going to change the production factories over to creating humanoid robots. Yeah. So it's a big push, and I mean, we've seen it, I think, in one of the recent shows, the Chinese robot, which I think only stands about 4'3" tall. But it proved to be very approachable for people, and was sort of broken down the fear of responding. Whereas I think the humanoid robot that Tesla are doing is taller, and psychologically that changes our opinion. I guess it's a bigger threat, literally, is the thought that goes through your mind. But there's a lot of shift scientifically now towards that end. But again, the sort of background to that is what happens to humans being involved in work, employment, and things like creativity we've spoken about before, where potentially these things can start to take over and do some of the creative things like songwriting or art and take things forward and take it away from human beings. And I think the sort of long ago the argument was this would give us a relaxed place in society where we can just do the things we like to do.
Oh, if only, Paul. And you get paid for doing that.
Absolutely. I think that's the answer that nobody seems to sort of come up with. We get lots of free time, but time is money, as they say. Or money is time. But
it's interesting that that Tesla are going into humanoid robots, because they're already looking, you know, manufacturers are already into autonomous vehicles, aren't they? So it's not that far, is it, away from...
No, it is. And I forget who they are now. There's a UK company that's looking to create humanoid robots. And they're actually going to have them produced in China, because the argument was a lot of the components that are being used in these are being built in China. So very sophisticated motor drives and things for the movements of these robots. China's actually invested hugely in, and they're testing and creating generations of these various robotic devices. I think the UK one was a kind of a pivot point, I think, for robotics, where for a lot of the things that initially they can be used in industry, there's a question about whether it's a valid sort of development for a humanoid robot to have legs. It's far easier to put it on a wheels platform and just have the sort of upper body and arms, so you've got basically cameras to see the vision, some kind of a brain processing and movement of the arms and the hands in detail, so that they can do some of the human things that need to be done. A lot of the other ones are trying to build the complete humanoid representation with legs, but it's showing just exactly how complex a process that is for us, learning to stand up when we're wee things and start to walk, and eventually as we get older, still keeping on our feet and not falling over.
Don't we know it, Paul?
Absolutely. So I think it's an interesting world that we're seeing, and a lot of places where they're developing robotics for use, there are things where we've been using a form of robotics in managing nuclear power stations. The robotic arms that deal with things like spent fuel rod changes, so that if we don't have a human being having to get radiated, we can put in a robot between us. And developing the things that are happening with things like war in Europe with Ukraine, the massive sort of increase in the use of drone technology, and that's not only the little sort of buzzy drones that you see in the air, which are used in huge quantities, bigger drones that carry sort of more explosive ordnance and things, but also sea drones, things that actually are operated on the sea remotely, and a lot of things like robotic drones to go into the depths of the ocean, because they can withstand the pressure much better than us frail human beings.
Very interesting. Paul just pulled an article up about a company called Waymo, US-based driverless car firm, and they're looking to start operating a robo-taxi service in London later this year.
Yeah, absolutely.
Piloting it, yeah.
I think that same company that actually got, I think, three different countries where they're running pilot sort of robot taxi schemes. And there's also a development, I'm not quite sure it's from Amazon, I think, of a driverless cab, which is essentially a very squared shape with lots of glass sliding doors that open on the side, where the passengers don't necessarily sit facing forward, but can sit facing one another in the seats as the driverless cab takes them wherever they're going. Not quite sure how that works for a lot of people, because you quite often see people on the trams changing seats.
Yeah, people don't like going backwards, do they?
some don't. Some don't mind. It's very strange, and you find it on trains and lots of other things. And I guess the other arguments about who sits by the windows.
I'll get the best view.
Yeah.
Yeah. Very interesting. It's true, isn't it? But if you get to sit down on public transport, Paul.
Yeah.
That's a bonus. Sometimes.
Especially trains.
Oh yeah. I know. The other thing I was going to mention is the moon. Which tomorrow is the snow moon.
Oh.
Yeah, so called because it's in the winter. It's the time when snow is generally about. It's also called the hungry moon, and it's got another name as well. I think just to say we're in the depths of winter, so food's scarce, light's scarce, but snow is probably something that's plenty. But it's supposedly going to be very viewable from sort of late afternoon through, and will continue. I think tonight you'll get a view of it. Tomorrow you get the full view, and after that you'll still have a bit of a view for the day beyond. So another aspect of the sort of naming of the moons.
Yeah, indeed. Maybe Phil Muffett will be able to tell us more.
Yes, hopefully. I think I wondered if Phil might touch on it, but if not, at least we've flagged it.
I think he wants to tell us about one of his Christmas presents, a trip to Jodrell Bank, no less.
Yes. Aye, gum, yeah.
Indeed. Anyway, we're going to play you out with a track by Golf Rap Paul, Human.
Oh, excellent.
Here we go, and yeah. It's live. Ooh.
Cheers.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Bye. Bye.
They fall from your mouth, propelled by your belly and your tongue. I shower when you're shaking, and I fall into jelly. I think I loved you more than me. Are you human or a dunt? Are you human or do you make it up? My baby cherry slip, pass me through your fingertips.
Interesting track that, Golf Rap Live with a track called Human, because RPG was talking really about humans versus humanoids. All very interesting. Listen to the Life Science Radio Show, of course, here on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM. We should have Phil Muffett on the line.
I wish I was a spaceman, the fastest guy alive. I'd fly you around the universe in Fireball XL5. Way out in space together, conquers of the sky. My heart would be a fireball.
Good morning, Phil.
Good morning.
Good morning. You're under the stairs, aren't you? I can tell.
I'm in my office.
He's in his private office. Good morning, Phil. Thanks for joining us yet again.
Harry Potter.
Okay. I know, Harry Potter. So for people who don't know who you are, I don't know how that could be possible, but you're a member of the Mexburn Swinton Astronomical Society.
I am.
Hurrah! You're going from strength to strength, as far as I can tell.
Oh, yes, well, our PVEs are sold out within minutes.
Which is your private, public viewing events, aren't they?
The Public Observatory did one, was it last Friday? I forget now. Was it last Friday or the Friday before? It was last Friday. Yeah, we had 20 people up there. We split them into two. I had to do a planetarium show in the observatory because it was cloudy. It was raining.
Yeah.
In fact, it was whistling around the dome. And then downstairs, we had Roy Unson doing a presentation on the solar system.
But it didn't put people off, though, the weather, did it?
No, because we always make sure the looking at the stars is only half of the show. So we've got a telescope to show people, and using Stellarium, we've got a projector in the dome, so we can project the sky onto the side of the dome, and we can zoom in and zoom out, show people where things are and what we want to know.
So I bet you could sell those events out over and over, couldn't you? But you're limited in time and space, aren't you, basically?
Well, one of our problems is, because we're all volunteers and we do this because we enjoy it, it's having the people to do the events. And it's like, we can't do it every week because it starts impacting on your family life. We also help out the Cubs and Scouts. So they're on a Tuesday or a Wednesday.
Oh, right.
So the Cubs and Scouts have astronomy badges, so we help them out get their astronomy badges. So we do that as well. And so,
blimey,
it's busy. And then we do public viewing events in the summer to have a look at the sun.
I keep telling you, you need to retire, Phil.
I do. I'm getting there.
Oh, you're getting there. Yeah, don't blame you. So the most exciting thing, really, I want to talk about is, I think it was a Christmas present, was it, from your daughter?
It was.
Very clever idea. A trip to Jodrell Bank, no less.
Yeah. So I got a day to spend with my daughter walking around Jodrell Bank, and we watched a couple of movies in the visitor centre. Since I went back in the 1990s, they've built an underground visitor centre, which is really, it's like a modern Cold War bunker.
Yeah.
with a cafe. It's really, really nice. And they've got a lovely cinema room with a domed ceiling. And we went and watched a movie on going to the moon. I think it was called Capcom. And we also watched a film about going to Mars and how difficult it is. And it's very difficult. So, to be honest, I know going back to the moon's the next thing that we'll be doing very shortly. I think Artemis is going next month to around the moon and back, which is like a proving ground and a test for landing back on the moon. Now, going to the moon's difficult, but going to Mars, it's like fraught with danger. And the thing is, you've got all that time in which things can go wrong, or you've got to fix. It's a big step, a really big step, going to Mars.
So what did you think to Jodrell Bank? If you've not been for a while, you said you went in the 90s.
It must be 20 years since I've been. It's had a refurb since we last went. Had a club trip back in the 90s, and we actually got in the control room, and we could actually see all the workings, how the controller telescope and the computers and all the knobs and switches that are all plugged in. And it was fascinating. And the thing about Jodrell Bank is, because it's a radio telescope, you can actually do it 24 hours a day. So it doesn't matter if it's cloudy or windy.
Uh-huh.
You can see through the clouds at different wavelengths and still pick up, receive information. So that's one of the really, really big bonuses about radio telescopes. Or radio astronomy, you can do it daytime and in bad weather.
I can tell, Phil, this is what you need. Well, have you got one?
I've already built some radio stuff. I think, you know, we've done radio work with meteors.
Yes.
So I've got a scanner and a radio, and I've had myself for quite some time, which I got for listening to the Mir Space Station, International Space Station, and the Space Shuttle, which we've done. You can tune into things like meteors hitting the atmosphere or the ionosphere, we used a, or we use a radio transmitter in the south of France, and they send pulses into space tracking satellites. Well, if you point your a radio telescope in the right direction, you can pick up echoes from the ionosphere when meteors strike the ionosphere over Europe. And we've actually done that, and we can do that already. So, yeah, but there's other things you can tune into as well. But, yeah, it's interesting. But the thing is about, all the thing about radio telescopes is you can link different telescopes together called an interferometer. And George L. Banks, now the head of Merlin, which is the multi-element radio link interferometer network, which is over the UK, I think, into Europe, and you can link the signals together, so you end up with a radio dish as big as a country.
Oh my word!
So that is a really good bonus about using radio telescopes. You can also link it to telescopes like the Parkes radio dish, which is in Australia, and you can also link it to the one in America as well. So you can actually have a footprint as big as the Earth to like tune into space, which gives you bigger resolutions, so you can see distant, smaller, fainter things.
Wow.
It's amazing. Radio astronomy is really amazing, but it's just more technical than having a telescope and looking through it.
Yeah, yeah.
You've got to have the hardware, and the computing power to be able to do this. But you can do it on amateur gear. You can buy radio sets, you can buy programs for your computer and dongles and plug them in, and you can do radio astronomy. Like I said, the meteor stuff's the easy stuff to get into. And then there's also listening to the sun, because that's also giving off energy. When we get like radio spikes, we're getting like energy from the sun, like for aurora and stuff like that.
Oh, so that's how you get your warnings then, that something's happening?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, at the moment, when you use the apps on your phone, they actually use two satellites in space. I think it's Geo 8 and 9, and they're tuned into the cosmic rays from the sun. And when we get like large spikes, they pick them up first and inform us we're going to get like an aurora event of whatever magnitude it's going to be, because they detect them as well as provide pictures as well.
Right. So we were going to talk about auroras. Before we do, as a visitor to Jodrell Bank, then, how would you rate it as an overall experience? Because you know quite a lot about all this sort of stuff.
It's a 10 for me.
Oh!
It's a 10 for me. It's, even if you're not interested in radio astronomy, just going and seeing the Jodrell Bank radio telescope, it's an amazing piece of engineering. I think it's still the third largest steerable radio dish in the world. And I think it's in the top six of still being the largest dishes in the world, because there's a couple built into mountains, but they're only partly semi-steerable in that the antenna box rather than the dish.
Have you any idea why Jodrell Bank was built where it was built?
Well, Manchester University, whilst Bernard Lovell was like a physicist, and he did radio, and he worked out how he's a father of radio communication and radar. And during the war, they had because of the noise, the radio noise, they had to move out of Manchester, and they had a plot at Jodrell Bank, which I believe was an agricultural centre.
Oh.
And so they like used one of the fields, built a radio array for picking up information. And I think that's where radio astronomy was born. And they had an aerial array on the floor that they could spin round only horizontally. And then from that, he developed the dish, which I think was built in 1957. And it kind of progressed from there. So they used it in the Cold War. They used it to track Sputnik. They used it as an early warning radar for the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Wow.
And in 1966, I think they also picked up the first photo from the moon, which was a Russian Lunik 9 probe that landed on the moon, and they received the information back. We also tracked Sputnik for the Russians, and we also eavesdropped on the Americans when they sent the Apollo to the moon as well. So it's up there with the absolute best of them.
Amazing. Well, we went in '90s, Phil, and Paul reckoned he knew where it were. 3 hours later, we ended up in Cheshire.
It's in Cheshire.
Well, it sort of is, isn't it? But it was like, oh my God! But we're going to go. We're
miles away.
I know. But
if you fly out to Manchester, if you fly out to Manchester Airport,
you can see
on the left hand side of the link, flying west. You can actually see the dish. It's huge.
I know. Aircraft. Well, we had to stop. Nice went into a police station, and they went blah blah blah. Anyway, we are going to go back. Because we know you've been. We're going to go back.
Definitely worth going. They've improved it since the 90s, for sure.
Amazing.
I think they repainted it about 10 years ago. So there's a bit of rust creeping back in again. But there's so much metal. It's like the Fourth Bridge. It's massive.
Amazing.
And the visitor centre's got some really good exhibits in there.
Yeah.
And they've got part of the original dish in there as well. It's well worth a visit.
And what about the cafe? Come on.
Yeah, cafe's good.
Good.
Yeah, cafe's okay.
Important, you know.
And make sure you watch a film. We've got some nice films.
Amazing. What a Christmas present, eh?
Yeah, it was a good day out, a really good day out. And even though it was cloudy, it was, when we got over to Manchester, it started to break a bit. So it was even more sunny over there than over here.
Amazing. So next up is auroras, because I think there were some alerts.
Yeah. So we think we passed the maximum of the solar peak for activity, but the sun's still giving off some big solar bursts. And we got one last week. And guess what? It was cloudy and raining. I even stopped up while 12. I think the alert went off probably about 6 o'clock. And it went on for over 24 hours. So it was a real big one. It was down over the UK. My friend who lives on the Lizard in near Goonillie Downs, where the other radio dishes are, he got a photograph from Cornwall of the aurora that we were experiencing over the UK.
So jealousy, eh?
And it was visible. We were just under a big cloud.
Oh, you know, astronomy, though, that's nature, isn't it? You just got to get on with it, haven't you?
It is. We're slaves to the weather, unfortunately.
Disappointed. So, is there a lot of jealousy around this then? That the your friend down in the Lizard Point down south got a brilliant picture.
But they did have a really, really bad storm the week before.
True.
I think they had winds in the high 90s. I think on the Scilly Isles, I think they topped 100 miles an hour. On the Scilly Isles, that I forgot which storm it was, but it were really bad.
Oh, yeah, we've had a lot, haven't we, recently?
The weather's changed, and I've heard a report that apparently the polar vortex that is over the North Pole. So you know how we get banding of weather across the globe. When you get up to the Arctic, it's like one circular weather formation. Well, apparently some of the warmer air has punched into this and tried to split it. So it shifts the cold air over North America and over Russia. And apparently they've experienced some really, really
nasty
storms.
Yeah.
And again, it's because of this warm weather that's come up from down south. And that's the other thing. We've had some really, really wet nights as well. So I think I've had the telescope out twice this month.
Oh, boo.
So using my new GoTo that I've incorporated into the telescope. The first time I used it in the month, I couldn't climb the moon. It was about 15 degrees off. I did it the other day in the daytime before it got dark, and it actually got to the moon, but it didn't centre it. I'm hoping next time, that was without the proper polar alignment, but I'm hoping next time I'm going to get it spot on. But then the fog came in. It wasn't even dark and fog came in, so it's been a disaster.
Oh, Phil,
But I have had a little practice on my new gear, and it is getting better.
So this new gear, what did you say? It's a go-to, did you say?
So I bought, well, my wife's bought me an Azzy Air Plus, which is a computer hub that's pre-programmed with all the astro gear and technology you need to drive a telescope autonomously,
buy
a telephone, and take pictures, and then send them back to your phone. So you basically, it's an autonomous radio wireless telescope.
Oh.
So, and everything's on your phone. You just need to make sure it's all nice and safe in your backyard.
Oh, so it's all set. It's all set up, and so wherever you are.
So you put your telescope out in the back garden. I've got it linked. The hub's linked to my Wi-Fi. My phone's connected to my Wi-Fi. So via my Wi-Fi, I can connect. I can drive my telescope while I'm in the house.
Oh, comfort.
Yeah, well, exactly. It is more comfortable when it all works, and it's proven itself. But the other thing is, all the photo techniques that you have on these robotic sea stars that people are buying, where everything's on your phone and you just press go, it's all on this hub. So I've basically turned myself, I'm turning my telescope into one of these, like a sea star. But you can put it on any telescope. So when you buy a sea star, they're about a 50 mil diameter lens, which limits you to your magnitude and your resolution. Whereas with this method, you can fasten it to a bigger telescope, whether it's a refractor or a reflector, depending on what kind of astronomy you can want to do. But it just improves everything and takes a lot of the stress and a lot of the work out of what you have to do yourself.
So that was at top of your Christmas wish list then?
It was. It's proving technically challenging, but
yeah, but the you need
you become a dinosaur.
You need a challenge, don't you? But hey, you've been spoiled then. New toys.
Yes, I've been spoiled.
Trip out.
Yes.
Blimey. So what else has been happening with your telescope and photography then?
Yeah. So I'm starting on the moon because it's like early in the evening and it's lighter. And I think it's a bigger target to find. Once I can refine my setup and how I use it and get some photographs, I can then start to move on to some planets and then hopefully stars and nebula and get some paid stuff.
But that's how you would tell somebody who's just starting astronomy, yes, wouldn't you? Don't worry about exactly everything. Have a look at the moon first, because you can't miss it.
Yeah, it's like we keep saying, when you go out, you look. Don't just go out at night time and think, what am I going to look for tonight? Work out what's up there, what you can see, what's practical, and are you going to use your eyes, telescope or binoculars? And then you can start to refine what you want to look at, how you're going to look at it, and not come away disappointed. And all other thing is, set yourself a limit and say, well, I'm going to go out for an hour or half an hour. Make sure you're suitably clothed. Well, I was the other thing, I think a couple of nights ago, I started getting my gear out because it was looking promising. It was that icy. It was me after it being wet, it was a death trap. I got my tripod out and I nearly ended up in our pond.
You see,
be honest, I thought, you know what, it's not worth the risk. So I stopped there and put my phone things away. I thought, If I can't get my gear out, it's not going to work.
And if you slip, A, you're going to be trouble, but what about all your equipment?
Yeah, exactly.
Ooh.
Yeah. So I thought, So health and safety.
It kicked in.
It did.
We had a lot of black ice around our estate a couple of weeks back. It was lethal.
Mm. Well, the other thing is, if you deal with them temperatures and you're exposed in your back garden, your equipment starts to freeze up or gets damp. And then freezes up. And the other thing is you've got to consider is when you take it to pieces, put it away, it will be freezing. And it's like if you're cold and your hands are cold, you can't feel stuff, you're either not going to be able to loosen your gear off to take it to pieces.
Yeah.
Or you're going to drop something and it'll be expensive.
Expensive. And once you've done it, haven't you? And then it's like the point of no return. But it sounds like you're moving more into autonomous.
Well, I'm keeping two different rigs. I've got a large reflector, which I am using the DSLR camera, and a laptop. But my smaller telescope, which is a refractor, which is a wider field, I'm going to try and make this autonomous so I can take like deep field sky images of like nebulae and star fields, whereas my reflector, I'm going to try and use that for smaller, fainter stuff. So I want to keep my options open, depending on what I'm looking at to do different jobs.
Yeah, so before I let you go, Phil, when you think about the year ahead, so we're into January now, you always have a list of what you want to achieve. So how far are you on with your what you wanted to do this year?
Okay, well I've got my seat, my autonomous piece of kit up and running. It's going to take me all year to
learn how to use it. Yeah,
but I've got my eye on things like Neptune, which is starting to fade now. Saturn's going down. Uranus is high. Jupiter's high up, and then we've also got Orion at the moment. So for the next month, I'm going to be kind of concentrating on them and trying to get better images. And then we're going to move into Leo, where there's probably some more galaxies, and Virgo later at Easter. The thing is, as we start to move into Easter, the nights are going to get lighter.
Oh, so you can't win, can you, in this game?
Push my times back.
I know.
But I just thought there was a couple of good comets. We've been tipped off. There's a bright comet coming round, but you can never be sure.
Brilliant. Let you go, Phil. All being well, you're going to join us next.
Thank you, Phil.
You're going to join us next Saturday to do the iron, just to iron the sky, your club news and everything.
Yeah, we'll see what's happening in the sky.
Fantastic. Happy viewing, Phil.
Thank you.
Have a nice week.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
See you later.
Bye. Bye-bye.